heard many variations of the story about the cocaine bear.
The what bear?
Cocaine. Cocaine.
Yes, the cocaine bear. That's a very interesting story in itself.
Fascinating Stories is the story of Drew Thornton. Thornton was a police officer.
He was an addict, addicted to adrenaline and excitement.
People say he was as ludicrous could be.
He had about 70 pounds of cocaine on him.
He had a James Bond wristwatch that shot tear gas.
A lot of people noted he was wearing Gucci loafers.
Well, this is very strange.
He developed one of the biggest organizations I've ever seen.
There's corruption, murder,
gun running, you name it.
You would never believe this happened.
Welcome back to another edition of Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streamosphere. The title of the documentary for this episode is Cocaine Bear, The True Story. This documentary dives deep into the bizarre actual events behind the hit Hollywood movie Cocaine Bear, directed by Robert Palumbo and Tom Pollock. And you can catch this streaming on Peacock. All right, let's talk through it. Now, for reference, I haven't seen the movie. Only thing I've seen are clips, and I read like a synopsis of the movie or saw a brief little snippet and saw that it was a true story. So we're starting off in North Georgia. We're in the woods of North Georgia, and we hear this lady, the narrator, come on. She is saying, we're in the backwoods of the Chattahoochee National Forest, North of Georgia. Now, this is a remote place, and I mean, it looks like just wood, just nothing. And whatever part of the season we in now, there's like no leaves or nothing on the trees. All right, so we're in December of 1995, and we see this headline, The Courier Journal, Monday, December 23rd, 1985, Black Bear took its last snort on cocaine ditched in Georgia. All right, so this is where the legend starts. And they zoom in on part of this article. The bear ingested substantial quantities of cocaine, said Alonzo. It probably ingested 2, 3, or 4 grams of cocaine. It could have been more. So we meet this lady. She's telling us how big of a legend this story is. And we're just going through a bunch of these different headlines. Autopsy to determine if North Georgia Bear died of cocaine snack. So now we're looking at the cast of Cocaine Bear. Oh, I didn't even know Ice Cube's son was in it. O'Shea. And then what is this? There's a girl. There's this girl with pasties on. I'm trying to see if I recognize any more of these characters. Oh, it looks like Felicity. Is that Felicity in there? And I'm horrible with celebrity names, but I know O'Shea. And all these other people look recognizable. I haven't seen the movie. I'll probably watch it on the airplane tomorrow. I'll probably download it if it's streaming somewhere and watch it on the airplane. And so now they're just showing clips from the movie. They're showing one of the actresses. Can you still say actresses? Or is it everybody just actors? One of the actors is Jimmy Kimmel? No, not Jimmy Kimmel. The other one. Fallon. And they're just showing different shots from the movie, and they're going back to interviews. Now we with Kimmel. What is the girl name? Kerry Russell? Is it Kerry Russell? I don't know. If it's not Kerry Russell, she looks like Kerry Russell. So they're just setting up showing the dramatized version versus what really happened. All right. So now we're doing we're breaking the third wall with this scene marker, Cocaine Bear, the documentary, and now we're going to be talking to Fran. So her name is Frances Bishop Wiley. And in December of 1995, she was an assistant special agent in charge of the GBI, and she's retired now. So she was part of the GBI. She get this call. A game warden had called and said he found a bear in the woods. Along with the bear, there was a parachute and duffel bag nearby. So she dispatched some of her agents to the area, and they reported back to her, said, yeah, dude wasn't bullshitting. There was a bear with a duffel bag and a parachute laying close to him. So, of course, this is an odd situation to come up on. So she told him to take it back to the lab, the GBI lab. Take what? The fucking bag? Oh, no. So the duffel bag. So they ended up taking the duffel bag. It did test positive for cocaine residue, but that was it. It was just residue. Now, what would... Okay. I've never come in contact with pure cocaine before. Is cocaine something that an animal would want to eat? Does it have a smell? Like, why would an animal eat cocaine? So she's pondering, like, if there's no cocaine in the duffel bag, where did the cocaine go? And they figured the bear must have ate it. And so now we at Knoxville, Tennessee, September 1985. And so this is where the actual story begins. 3 months before September 1985, Knoxville, Tennessee. We see this guy jump out of the plane. And this guy in the middle of the night hears this sound like a thump or a crash. And it was in his backyard. So he goes out. Well, he didn't even go out that night. He just like, all right, you know, it's like at night when you hear something and, you know, you look out the window, you don't want to go out there. That's why I got cameras around my house, because a lot of times we hear stuff around, then we look on the camera, it's like a fox or some animal or some shit. So this dude was like, nah, I ain't going there. So it wasn't until the next morning that he looked into his driveway and then he called the cops. Now, we're with Jimmy J.J. Jones. He's a retired Knox County sheriff. And he said, since he was 16 years old. Okay, this guy is going to be the comedic relief. I can already tell. He said since he was 16, he knew he was going to be a sheriff.
The office that day, it was a normal day, just like any other day. The call came in from dispatch. He was an elderly gentleman, and he said that there was a gentleman out in his driveway who was trespassing, and if the police didn't come, he would take care of it himself.
The trespasser is the dead body of a skydiver. And JJ is called to the crime scene.
So JJ heads over to the scene and so I'm thinking this is like for dramatic effect, because they show the body and he's in like a green flight suit. They show the body, but they blurred out his face as if this was the actual photo. But I don't think it is, because it doesn't look dated. It looks like, I don't know. So anyway. So we're going between JJ standing outside the house currently in present time and looking at police footage from back in the day. And the video is labeled Parachutist Crime Scene. This is WIR-TV. And JJ is saying it looks like the parachute didn't fully open. It was kind of like wadded up instead of, you know, like open on the ground. It was just kind of wadded up like he had a bad parachute. The guy ended up having a duffel bag. When I say duffel bag, it's like a military style duffel bag, like a rucksack almost. And it had 30 to 40 bricks of cocaine labeled USA on it. And we see the actual police video footage of this. And he says when they cut it open, it was still wet, like still moist. And the smell, it had a smell. It was like fresh cocaine, either freshly cut, freshly processed, or whatever. But he said he can tell that it was a high quality of coke. So somewhere between 30 and 40 kilos, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And we see a young young footage of JJ at this crime scene. He was 24 and 25 years old at the time. And currently his hair is stark white. It's funny, like looking at you guys heard his voice. Looking at him now, his voice matches him. But looking at the young him, it doesn't seem like he would have that voice. And so we're looking at this body, right? So this guy, he has on a green flight suit with a brown, like a dress belt around his waist. And then it looks like he had a holster with a gun on it. Then he got some loafers, like penny loafers. And then on one arm, he has a pilot's watch. And then on his right arm is some sort of, it's another watch that looks like a compass or something like that. And I guess this is actually the real body. And they have the face blurred out. I don't know why they had a face blurred out. Like by now people, I don't know who he is, but anybody who know the case would know who he is, I think. So then we hear this other guy talk. He's Michael York. He's saying that it was an attack knife, some daggers or spears that was in like an orange sheath. There was night vision goggles. He had $5,000 in his pocket. He had stones in a money belt. So this dude had all sorts of, like, even gold Krugerrands, whatever the hell that is. Yeah, Krugerrands. And we see an actual picture of this. So there's like these gold coins with a, looks like a gazelle or something on them. And, oh, okay. So we see a notation saying it's actually a springbok. So it's a 1978 Krugerrand. What the hell is a Krugerrand? Anyway, he had a pocket full of these things. So who this guy is a mystery. And so the other watch, remember I said he had like a, well, what I thought was a compass on one arm, but it wasn't. It was a watch that sprayed tear gas. And JJ describes it as like a James Bond watch. And the loafers that he had on were Gucci loafers. So the plane crashed in Hayesville, North Carolina, a Cessna 404, and it was the Nantahala Mountains. So the body and the plane crash are approximately 100 miles from each other. And the plane is registered to a dude in Lexington, Kentucky. And so the local papers end up getting a hold of it. And we're talking to Michael York, investigative reporter, and for the Lexington Herald Ledger from 1979 to 1987. So they identified the body as Andrew Thornton. And Andrew Thornton, but they call him Drew, he was a cop. He was a cop. He was a vet. And he, I guess, was from some esteemed family. And so this guy, Michael York, saying when he heard it was him, he wasn't surprised. Evidently, this Drew guy, he kind of lived on the edge. And, you know, I guess he had always been doing stuff like this. So his luck had just run out. So it wasn't no surprise that he was the one in that driveway dead. So now they got the body identified. They trace his flight path, and in the process of this, they find out there's more cocaine that had been dumped along this flight path. So they realized that the one Drew had on his back when he was found in that driveway was the same sort of duffel bag that was found near the bear. So this story finally hit the TV news, and we listened to Patricia Hunt, Atlanta, Georgia 11 News Live. And she's saying that the medical examiner says that the bear had been dead for about 6 weeks. And none of the cocaine that showed traces in that duffel bag, like there was none confiscated, none left at that scene where the bear was. So according to the coroner, the bear did not eat 75 pounds of coke. So they said it either dissolved or blew away. So wait a minute. So why is it? What? Okay, so now it's a mystery. I thought sure this was about a bear who ate up some cocaine, but according to the coroner, that doesn't seem to be the case, at least not yet. Well, damn, that's what drew me to the story. So now that they know who the guy is, you know, Drew Thornton, now they got to see what's going on with this, these cocaine drops all over the place, a dead body in this residential driveway, in a crash airplane. Okay, so now we rewind. We're going back decades to Kentucky. And what the narrator says is the heartland of blue blood society. So we meet Ron Bryant. He was a historian for Kentucky State Park System and director of Waveland State Historic Society. So his family has been there for 200 years, and he's a distant relative of Daniel Boone. Daniel Boone was a man. He said, you know how the joke goes that everybody in Kentucky is related to each other. He said, well, there may be some truth to that. The gene pool was relatively shallow. So with Andrew Thornton, Andrew was from, he was a child of privilege. And according to what we think about people who get into trouble and do crazy shit, this shouldn't have happened to a child of privilege. But I don't know, man, the last few documentaries I've done, they've all been from privilege. American Pain, those two goofball was from privilege. The three dudes from the Chowchilla kidnapping, and this one, three in a row. And just totally coincidental that these people that's been the subject of these documentaries, or the perpetrators of some crime in these documentaries, have all been privileged. So he's just saying, like, according to how this guy was raised, he shouldn't have been doing this stuff. Like, if you go by stereotypes. So society, especially where he's from, was in this a state of absolute shock. So Andrew was a junior. He was the son of Andrew Carter Thornton, and they had established themselves in the horse industry in Kentucky. And they had two Derby winners in the family. So they had thoroughbreds. And so they are saying that Andrew Thornton, he went to University of Kentucky, but it wasn't right for him. And then he went into the Army and actually received a Purple Heart. And he particularly liked flying and parachuting. So he was, what you mean? So he was a pilot and airborne? Okay, so in 1968, Thornton, he returned home as a hero, and then he got married. But his marriage doesn't last. So because of his appetite for danger, I guess his marriage didn't last. So he ended up being a cop. So we meet this guy, Jim Huggins. He was a supervisory special agent for the FBI in Kentucky, in Lexington, Kentucky, from 86 to 95. So he worked closely with the Kentucky State Police Intelligence Bureau. And in the 70s, at that time, there was a lot of drug activity starting to show up, and mostly around college campus. So they must be talking about weed. And so that was one of the biggest crimes they were, the local cops were working with, was drugs around the college campuses. So they ended up creating this first NARC squad. And so that's what kind of drew Andrew Thornton to that, because he wanted to become a part of this NARC team. So there was this other guy who he became best friends with, named Bill Kanan. And Bill Kanan was already working there for this squad, this narcotic squad. And Bill Kanan, his background was a lot different from Andrew Thornton. His family was working class, and Andrew Thornton was drawn to Bill Kanan because he was, you know, he saw him as kind of like a tough guy. So they became buddies. So they started to sort of become like part of this community of students that were like into drugs. So they started hanging out at the college campuses, started sort of kind of dressed like these college students to get on the inside. And so they actually ended up becoming like, well, this is hearsay. They became scumbag cops. You know, they would go and arrest or bust the drug dealer, take his shit, and then don't turn it in. They would like keep it for themselves, and they will actually resell the drugs. And so again, you know, if this was just Bill, what is his name? Yeah, that was his name, Bill Kanan. You know, he's from a working class. He needs the money. But this other guy, this Drew guy, he don't even need the fucking money. Again, he's just doing stuff because he's, I don't know, a bored, privileged dude born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He wanted to see what the other side is like. So evidently, the talk was that there was something wrong with Andrew Thornton. Like he wasn't all there. Like, you know, people probably use the word eccentric, but I guess the talk was that he was a strange dude. So he, instead of being known as a pillar of society, like his family, like what should have been the path, he became known as like a pariah in society.
In 1975, the cocaine bear was just a cub, learning the bear way of life in the woods of Georgia. Meanwhile, more than 200 miles away in Lexington, Kentucky, Drew Thornton is relishing his role as a dirty cop with his tough guy partner, Bill Kanan, a world away from his respectable upbringing in Kentucky horse breeding society.
I think Andrew Thornton was one of these types of individuals that's grown up with a silver spoon, and they've gotten just about anything they wanted. So to have this kind of thrill is something that excites them. He was a bad dude.
I don't think Andrew Thornton was rebelling against his position in society. I think Andrew Thornton wanted a different type of life. That's all it was. He saw himself as being an adventurer, person that literally lived on the edge.
So this Thornton dude was a show off. He was like the guy who would always try to show off whatever it was, to the fact that he would demonstrate his arrest ability to his other coworkers, to the other cops. And so one time he tried to, you know, do the old Starsky and Hutch run and jump across the hood of a car, or they actually describe it as jumping over a car. But he had his gun on him, and so he was trying to jump over this car to show off, and the gun actually went off. I don't know how that happened. But anyway, the gun goes off and it ricochets and he shoots himself. He gets a ricochet bullet and injured himself. So it wasn't like anything major. It just kind of grazed his leg, but it made him probably like a dumbass. And so anyway, he starts to escalate his corrupt behavior from just, you know, street dealing and confiscating and reselling other drugs dealers' product. He started to fly illegal drug routes into Kentucky. So we meet this guy who's been a pilot for 40 years, and he's also an aviation writer and photographer. And this is the guy who's been talking. You know, one thing I noticed is that in these documentaries, when they have reenactments, you know, and they have casts, like actors playing people when they were younger or people who dead or whatever, playing people, they have those people listed in the credits. But I don't see the actual people being interviewed. It's like that's such a hard thing to find. Or maybe I'm not looking in the right place. Anyway, so this guy, he was actually fascinated by the story of Drew Thornton. And he's saying it's because of, you know, there's a personality type who looks to sort of make life bigger. So he's talking about the fact that how Drew, you know, went from street level crime to actually becoming a smuggler. And he was bringing in plane loads of marijuana for distribution throughout the state, like a major, at the time, a major operation, like some shit you see on Narcos. So Bill and Drew Thornton, they became major smugglers, cutting out the middleman, and they had these connections from these other guys to the point to where they became wholesalers. And so what he would do, his major times would be when there's a lot of other planes coming in, like on the weekend, so he can go under the radar and not be like, you know, it's one thing if you just the one plane going in now all these times. But, you know, if you try to mingle in when there's a lot of air traffic, then you're less likely to stand out. So that's what he was doing. And he was making a shitload of money doing this. So we're back in Lexington, Kentucky, January 1977. So, you know, this narcotics team that Cannon and Drew Thornton was supposed to be a part of, they started to recruit informants. So one of the informants that Bill wanted to recruit, her name was Melanie Flynn. And she was giving them information about the users, the dealers around the University of Kentucky. So she thought she was just helping out the local cops, thinking this is the right thing to do. But Mel, what she doesn't know is she's informing to crooked ass cops. But she starts to get smarter and starts to realize that, hey, wait a minute. I think these tips I'm giving to this Bill and this Thornton guy, I think they are recirculating this shit, like that they, these busts they making, I think they recirculate this shit back around. And she was right. So Bill and Drew actually start to realize that she's getting suspicious of them. And now, I don't know what they kind of skipped over. They don't say how, first of all, they don't say how she put it together that they were the ones putting the drugs back on the streets. And then they don't say, well, at least not yet, they don't say how Bill and Drew knew that she was becoming privy to them being crooked cops. But anyway, she's becoming a threat now because now she knows too much. She knows that, you know, she's been giving them the info and they haven't been taking it back to the cop shop. They've been using for themselves. So one day she's leaving work, going home, and she's never seen again. What? She just goes. She just vanished from the face of the earth. Never seen again. They ended up finding her car abandoned in an apartment complex on the north side of Lexington. And she was last seen two blocks away, parked at an intersection, talking to two people in a dark van. And after later investigation, the police think those two individuals were you know who. So these dudes moved from drug dealers, well, from crooked cops to drug dealers to now straight murderers. And even to this day, Melanie Flynn is still missing. So after, you know, she had been missing for a while, her purse was found by a fisherman at the Kentucky River. And then inside the purse, there was some medicine of hers. And that's how they knew it was hers. So by 1977, Drew ended up quitting the police force. So now he's full-time drug smuggling. And that was due to an IA investigation. And he decided just to quit. So he's full-time crook now. And just like a lot of these crooks, he thought he was smarter than anybody else. He wanted to push the envelope. He didn't have any fear. Never thought he would get caught. Just thought he was just too goddamn clever. And so now that he quit the force, they don't really say if Bill Cannon is still on the force, but he wanted to find some new partners to take his smuggling operation bigger. So he ended up meeting this dude named Bradley Bryant. And he was another, actually, he didn't meet him, but he was actually a childhood friend of Drew's. They went to the same private school in Lexington and the same military academy. So they had a long history together. And being that he went to a private school and all this shit, so he's from the same blue blood as Drew. And Bryant was this. So this guy was the best man at his wedding. So, yeah, so they were tight. And on top of that, this guy, he's a successful businessman with ties to organized crime all over the country. And he wanted to be a player in Vegas. So now we're in Las Vegas, Nevada. So Bradley Bryant went to Vegas and he met the Chagra brothers, Lee and Jimmy Chagra. And I guess these guys were big players in the drug business to the point that they had connections in South America, Mexico, Colombia. And they would allow Drew to import large amounts of marijuana to their in their region. So now we're in Colombia. Oh shit! So we going to Colombia. So with the amount of product he was moving from Colombia, he's gonna need a substantial plane. So the plane that he had was a four engine cargo plane, a World War II plane, and it was able to carry tons of marijuana into Kentucky. And his route took him from South America up the coast of Florida and over to North Georgia, the home territory of the cocaine bear.
He was bringing in what's estimated to be 10,000 pounds, 5 tons of marijuana.
In today's money, that's $5 million.
These are Kentucky blue bloods that got together to go into full-time smuggling and were pretty successful at it.
People don't understand what a process it would be to fly into a foreign country with a load of drugs coming back to the United States of America. That takes a unique individual.
They quickly ratcheted up their business, becoming a major organization in the Southeast, maybe the biggest at that time.
Okay, now we're in December 1978. Lee Chagra was killed in his office. And the suspicion was that it's retaliation from a rival kingpin or something like that. And so this brings unwanted attention to not only his brother, but also to Drew Thornton, you know, because he's smuggling for them. So within months of Lee Chagra being murdered, Jimmy Chagra was arrested. And so now Thornton's freaking out because he's connected to both of these guys. One's dead and one's in prison. So Jimmy Chagra was going to go on trial for his criminal activity. And the judge who was going to be overseeing this trial, his name is Judge John Wood. And they call him Maximum John because he's known to deal out maximum sentences. So the day before the trial was scheduled to start, Maximum John was murdered in his driveway. We see actual police footage from news footage from KXAS TV outside the home of Judge John Wood. And so the news reporters are here. They got there so quick that we still see them doing chest compressions. Is this the actual footage? Because they show them still doing chest compressions. So the news reporters got there like within the same time as the EMT and the cops and everything. And so they still working on him. The cops was kind of scrambling around, but he died. He ended up dying. So John Wood was assassinated by a hitman who was hired by Jimmy Chagra. But I guess if you know this judge is known to be cutthroat, he must be facing either the death penalty or something. I mean, at that point, it's like, what do you got to lose? But they're just going to get another judge like that. I don't know. That's dumb. Now you made yourself look more guilty. And we hear the historian saying, yeah, it didn't make a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Like people just don't do things like that. Like I said, they're just going to get another judge. So the narrator saying, perhaps it was a scare tactic, but it didn't work. I guess I can see that. Like if you're going to be the judge that gets picked after the previous judge was assassinated, you'd be like, shit. But it didn't work. So Jimmy Chagra ended up getting 30 years in prison. And we hear the narrator say that's not the strangest twist in this assassination. Chagra had hired a gentleman named Charles Harrison as the hitman. And Charles Harrison is the father of Woody Harrison. Okay, so I remember Woody Harrison's dad going to jail, but I didn't know. This is insane. I didn't know it was connected to this. So this became international news. We see all these news headlines. And I guess that was like one of the first time a judge had been, you know, assassinated. So now Drew Thornton is on the radar of the FBI. And there's nowhere he can hide. Okay, let's segue back to the bear for a minute. We forgot about the bear. So according to Fran, the cocaine bear was the second case that she worked in Georgia where an animal would die from ingesting cocaine. In September of 1982, the sheriff's offices had been called and said a farmer had found a blue canister on his farm. And the canister looked like a Yeti thermos. And his cows had gotten into this blue canister. And so the cows had white powder all over their faces, all over their snouts, all over their noses. And so the farmer's like, yeah, something's going on. My cows got, there's this blue canister. My cows got powder all over their damn faces. And so where did the cows get the damn cocaine from? What is going on? So they never figured that out. They never found that out. So they're wondering, was it the same supplier that dropped the cocaine for the cocaine bear? But it's like one small canister though. I mean, it couldn't have been, because back in 1980, and this is what the narrator's saying, Drew Thornton, he wasn't smuggling cocaine. He was still smuggling weed. So it couldn't have been him, unless it was his personal stash or something like that dropped out of the damn plane. So after the murder of the federal judge, Thornton became a person of interest for the FBI. And now we're outside the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building. And so we talked to the FBI and they said they got notified at the headquarters that, you know, that judge was murdered in Lexington and there may be a person in Lexington who's involved. So they got the killer. They got Harrison and they got old boy in jail already, the Chagra, Jimmy Chagra, who ordered the hit. Now they're trying to link all the people involved in this drug ring, this drug and this criminal ring. Even with all this heat on them, Thornton and Bryant are still smuggling drugs. Like, I mean, come on, man. One of your bosses gets murdered. One's in jail and he ordered a hit on the judge and they know it. They know for sure he did it. And they got the guy who performed, they got the hit man. And you still, like, how dumb is that? You still smuggling drugs in the, maybe he went to another location. Maybe he's doing it somewhere else. But no, they were still doing it in the same area. So what ended up happening was,
in 1981, at a hotel at the Philadelphia airport, Bradley Bryant's luck ran out. He was arrested with a huge supply of automatic weapons, night vision goggles, and sophisticated communication gear, something that one federal agent told me looked a lot like a camouflaged assassination kit.
Another weapon stash is discovered by the feds in a Lexington warehouse owned by Bryant.
Okay, so now, as they keep going through the story, they're showing all the connections. Okay, so Lee Chagra's dead. Jimmy Chagra's behind bars. They got the hitman that Jimmy Chagra hired, which is Woody Harrison's dad. Now they got Bryant. Shit, the only person left. Wait a minute, I thought there was another guy. I thought there was... Oh, okay. So I'm thinking about Cannon, but he wasn't part of this bigger ring. So now, yeah, they got Bryant. The only person left is Drew Thornton. And Bryant gets 15 years in jail. And so now, oh, there is one more guy. What is the? Oh, that's Bill Cannon. Yeah, so Bill Cannon is still part of it. So those are the original two from the beginning of the story are the two that's left. So hidden in those weapons that they confiscated from Bryant was a notebook, and inside the notebook was the name Andrew Thornton, along with code words. Like they try to come up with this kind of like code scheme for their marijuana smuggling missions. So he disappears. He dropped off the radar, and now he's on the run. So for months, what he was doing was just flying from airport to airport, just staying under the radar, trying to avoid being captured. So this was right up his alley because he liked the thrill of this. He liked the excitement behind this. You know, just when the heat is on him, he just hop on his plane and go to it. I mean, even though it's a like 4-engine cargo plane, but still, that's only so far this little plane can fly before it has to refuel, right? I mean, you think it wouldn't be that hard to catch this dude. So they just show, you know, reenactment of this plane just flying around, landing at different airports. So I guess this whole time they were tracking his communications and tracking his flights. And they end up catching him. But when they caught him, he didn't have any drugs on him. The plane was completely empty. So it seems like he got tipped off, or it just happened to be one of the times where he either hadn't picked up a load yet or he dropped off a load. So they caught him, but he didn't have anything on him. And we see this video, this news footage of him walking into the police precinct. So he was indicted for a conspiracy involving drugs, but he pleaded no contest to a single count of marijuana smuggling. And we see him in jail. This dude looks like a insurance salesman or a mattress salesman, a furniture salesman. So he ends up getting sentenced to only 5 months. Wow. So with all the heat on him, you know, everybody else is either dead or in prison, his marijuana business just collapsed. So he gets out. He still hasn't learned his lesson. And this is when he started going out on his own and smuggling in cocaine. So we hear this guy, former DEA agent. His name is Rick Sanders. He's saying, yes, in the 70s, it was all about marijuana. But when the 80s came, it was about that coke. You know, celebrities were using it, and it was attractive for smugglers. And so this guy, Rick Sanders, he joined DEA in 1983. He was assigned to work drug cases throughout Kentucky that took him to South America. And once he joined the DIA, he learned about Andrew Thornton. So they already knew about it. You know, he was known to the DEA. And you know, with Andrew Thornton now doing coke, he can make way more money with less trips doing coke than he did with marijuana. So now in 1983, all of Drew's connections are in Colombia, and he was using those connections to smuggle coke back into the U.S. So, you know, the FBI, I mean, the DEA and FBI, they are aware of him, but they, you know how they build a case. They want to get as much as possible. So now we are at September 10th, 1985, and we see this reenactment. We see Drew Thornton flying his plane at night, and he's flying a load of coke into the U.S. from Colombia. And his goal was to move cocaine into the Lexington area. But he was going to stop over in Georgia, where he had some of his partners waiting to offload the airplane. So everything started as planned, navigating the coast of Florida without any incident. And then he gets over Georgia, and this is all speculation, but a lot of it, most of the investigators, they agree upon the next few aspects of this story. So he didn't make the landing in Georgia like he was supposed to. He's flying over the National Forest, the Chattahoochee in Georgia, and he started to unload, like make drops of cocaine into the forest, like hundreds of millions of dollars of cocaine. He's just dropping into this forest. And so he attached a duffel bag to his parachute, and it was just, oh, so he was attaching the coke to parachutes and dropping them out. And then he had a 75 pound of coke strapped to himself. So when he got somewhere near the Knoxville downtown airport, he put the plane in autopilot and jumped. And something happened that he didn't expect, and his ass hit the ground. So whatever happened was that parachute didn't open. And so now they're trying to rewind and go through these theories. So theory one was that the main chute didn't open. Also, the reserve chute didn't open, or the reserve chute didn't fully inflate. All right, so that's theory one. Theory two is that due to the fact that he had this cut on his head, well, did he hit the ground? I'm surprised his head wasn't splattered on the ground. But anyway, so theory two, because of this bruise or cut on his head, they're thinking that perhaps he hit his head when he was going out of the door of the airplane and lost consciousness. So he knocked himself out and didn't even have an opportunity to open the chute. All right, so theory number three. I guess he did have a bunch of injuries to his face. So the medical examiner believed that load of cocaine had swung back around and caught him in the face and either knocked him out or had him dazed and confused where he couldn't even pull the chute. So even with those three theories, they are wondering, why did he decide to jump out of the plane anyway? So here, the word on the street was he felt like he was being surveilled by customs or the DEA. Well, yeah, he was. So this dude, yeah, he was, totally was. So, okay, so theory four is that he became, somewhere along this flight, he became paranoid that he was being followed or being tracked by the DEA, by a plane or a Coast Guard, and he freaked out due to paranoia and jumped out the plane. But going back, the DEA said they didn't have no, I mean, you know, they knew about him and shit, but they didn't have no plane tracking him, at least not from the United States. Okay, so now theory five. So theory five is that this was his plan all along. Like, he was stealing from the Colombians, and by intentionally crashing the plane, he could claim that, you know, something happened, had an accident, he crashed the plane and lost all the coke. But he, you know, it wasn't in the plane. He was dropping it out in the forest. And the reason why they come up with that is because the fact that he had all these parachutes on the plane and was attaching it to these coke stashes. So, yeah, that okay, so that definitely makes sense. Yeah, why would you have all those planes, those parachutes on the plane? But JJ said he don't think so. JJ is saying that he don't think he would be stealing from the Medellin. Oh, so he was working with the Medellin cartel. He said he wouldn't fuck with them. Because, you know, they knew who he was. And even if he did say they lost coke, they don't mean they would just say, oh, okay, that's cool. No, they would have murked his ass either way. If it was an accident or whatever, if he lived, he wouldn't have been alive for long if he lost some coke from the cartel. And that's what JJ is saying. He would have not lasted very long at all. All right, so there's a last theory. Theory number six.
We initially thought that other people were involved, but we didn't have any proof. This is a downtown Knoxville Island Home Airport, where Mr. Thornton parachuted into the residential area is about 250 yards as the crow flies above us on the hill. About 2 or 3 months after Thornton was found, another parachute was found on the far end of the runway. We theorized that Andrew Thornton let the other individual in the plane jump, and then Thornton put the plane on autopilot. He would jump out of the plane and let it go across the mountains in North Carolina and crash.
If there was one other person on the plane, it would have to be someone that Drew Thornton trusted. And I don't know of anybody back then that he trusted more than Bill Canaan.
I was wondering when Bill Canaan would come back up. So, yeah, so they think Canaan was on that plane. Thornton let him out, let Canaan out earlier, about 250 yards, like JJ said. And he set up the autopilot and everything, and then he was going to jump out. Okay, so another guy did come forward and say he was on the plane. So in 1990, a man named Bill Leonard told an amazing story. So this is the story he says. And he was telling this to a journalist at the Knoxville Sentinel newspaper. So Thornton talked Bill Leonard into traveling with him. Like, first of all, who the fuck is Bill Leonard? We haven't heard that name. So he talked Bill Leonard into going with him to help provide security. And Leonard thought this was going to be, you know, in Florida or somewhere in the Bahamas. But Thornton kept flying to where they ended up in Colombia. And Bill was like, what the hell? And so evidently this Bill wasn't like a guy who would be making up shit like this. He was a stand-up guy. So he was believable. He was never charged with a crime. And when he spoke with the former detectives from Lexington, they believe his story, but they were convinced that he was an unwilling accomplice in that smuggling ring. So What? No. But he said he was going to be providing security. Security for what? So even if he didn't go to Colombia and was just going to Florida or the Bahamas, then like, what are you providing security for? So that don't make sense. Unwilling participant? What did he think he was going to be providing security for? This dude didn't even have a job. He wasn't like an executive and needed like corporate security. So that don't make sense. And oh yeah, and this guy, he brings up a valid point. We forget not only was Thornton a pilot in the Army, he was airborne. So yeah, so this not a guy who just was on a plane and then, you know, well, let me jump out. He used to do that for a living. I totally forgot about that. So the fact that two chutes, I mean, I guess anything can happen, but the fact that two of his chutes didn't open, it's kind of crazy. Bill Leonard, on the other hand, he was inexperienced and he survived. So it's like, how could the experienced guy die in a parachute jump, but the inexperienced guy totally live? So nobody was ever able to answer that question. So all this shit is just still a mystery. Okay, so now we're back where we started. The cocaine drop in the Chattahoochee Forest, National Forest, the bears found by the cocaine, and we're back to Fran. Fran's like, so what happened to the cocaine? Did the bear eat it? And she said, no, the bear didn't eat it. The bad guys got it. 75 pounds of cocaine. The pathologist told her that the bear had consumed about 3 grams of the cocaine. So the bear did eat some of the cocaine. So 3 of the 75 pounds. And this was pure, this was like 95% pure. So she's saying that bear would have died with the first bite. So he didn't eat the whole damn, he wouldn't have been able to eat the whole thing. So her theory is that, you know, when he was making these drops, he had already planned for somebody to come and pick this stuff up. And then they did exactly that. And they saw that bear had already ate a chunk of it and died. And they just got the rest of it and hauled ass. But in this reenactment, they show the ground crew for Thornton coming there. They see the bear. They's like, oh shit. They poke it with a stick, make sure it's dead. But then they leave the duffel bag and they load the coke into another bag. Why would they leave it there though? Why would they leave the duffel bag there? Why wouldn't they just grab it and then haul ass? Well, I guess if it's, that still don't make sense because they said, to me, that don't make sense. Why would they leave the bag? They would just grab the bag and haul ass. But anyway, that's her theory. But it does make sense that bear wouldn't have been able to eat all of that coke. So now we at this, like this little gift shop, and they got all this cocaine bear memorabilia. And Fran is saying she heard many variations of the story about the bear. And I guess the bear is actually taxidermied and is on display. And they call it Pablo Escobar. Cocaine Bear, a.k.a. Pablo Escobar. Here sits Cocaine Bear. He's sitting with this hat on and she don't believe it's the same bear because she said he was in no condition to be taxidermy. Okay, so nobody believes that's the same bear. But the purveyors of this shop said it is 100% the cocaine bear. And then they also state that if disbelief is your choice, then we created the most fantastic story ever. So this shit is still a mystery. What happened is still a mystery. Why he jumped is still a mystery. Hey, what happened to all that cocaine? That's a mystery. All those bags he dropped, did they confiscate it all? What happened to Bill Canaan? Is that the real cocaine bear? There was a lot of, I mean, it is the South. There's a lot of hyperbole. Even down to the fact, you know, when it started off, they said he was wearing Gucci loafers. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't know. It does a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff that's still a mystery. Even a lot of stuff that's like that was said, but now we come to the end of this thing. They're changing the truth about that as well.
The whereabouts of the real cocaine bear is as mysterious as so much of this legend. This story began with reports of a dead parachutist found wearing Gucci loafers.
There were incorrect accounts as to what exactly he was wearing on his feet.
There was one indication that he had Gucci loafers.
In reality, Thornton's shoes were described as the Gucci loafers of the parachuting world.
He had some very expensive jumping shoes on. When I was told about them, they were equated to Gucci. That's how they tried to correlate it to me, was this would be like Gucci. I don't think we'll ever know what really happened. I think we have gotten pretty close with the bits and pieces and the puzzles that we put together with the individuals that are still alive and the agencies that did the legwork that they did. I think we got as close to knowing what happened as we ever will.
A curtain was drawn over the conspiracy, the drugs, the murders. I had to go to my grave with that on my conscience. I would not want to stand very tall on the day of judgment, is all I could say.
Bradley Bryant served his time and then dropped out of sight. Bill Canaan was jailed in 1994 for federal drug charges. He passed away in 2020. And as for Drew Thornton, his myth lives on, alongside that of the cocaine bear.
He was a bad guy. These guys did this stuff for fun, and that's kind of scary.
Thinking about Andrew Thornton and the cocaine bear, would have Thornton liked to have been associated with that? I think he would have thought the bear was getting more attention than he did, and I don't think he would have liked that whatsoever, but he probably would have been amused by it.
That's going to be it for this episode. Send all your questions and comments and recommendations for a documentary to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.